Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. With the Rohingya refugee crisis now in its fourth year, Bangladesh needs robust support for the safety and well-being of its stateless exiles, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Friday. Moreover, the COVID-19 pandemic has compounded vulnerabilities for refugees and host communities alike. UNHCR spokesperson Andre Mahesik called for renewed international commitment, support, and solidarity, warning this must not become a forgotten crisis. The 2021 Joint Response Plan for the Rohingya Humanitarian Crisis is due to be launched at a donor conference on Tuesday. The $943 million plan seeks to assist over 880,000 Rohingya refugees and 472,000 Bangladeshis in the surrounding Cox Bazar district communities, where some 740,000 fled violence in Myanmar's Rakhine State in 2017. Co-hosted by the government of Bangladesh, the International Organization for Migration, and UNHCR, the virtual 2021 launch event will highlight the most important needs and ongoing humanitarian response. Turning to the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO said on Friday that animal-to-human diseases are the primary source of most infectious diseases, launching a new initiative to help prevent future pandemics. Currently, South Asia is in the hot seat as COVID-19 continues to claim lives and ruin the health and livelihoods of millions across the region. FAO's Emergency Center for Transboundary Animal Diseases, known as ECTAD, has kicked off a two-week series of meetings to map out a five-year plan on how to predict, prevent, and if necessary, combat the next potential transboundary animal pandemic in Asia and the Pacific. ECTAD consists of a team of veterinary scientists, epidemiologists, and other multidisciplinary experts who plan and deliver assistance to member countries responding to the threat of animal health crises. Outbreaks such as COVID-19, Ebola, and many others began because the virus jumped from animals to humans. And finally, independent UN and other human rights experts have condemned a violent government crackdown on peaceful demonstrators and journalists across Colombia. As the COVID-19 pandemic has triggered the loss of income for millions there, protests erupted when the government proposed a tax increase last month. 3 weeks later, despite the proposed tax plan withdrawal, the demonstrations are continuing. Amidst reports of at least 26 killings, over 1,800 cases of police violence, some 168 enforced disappearances, and 963 cases of alleged arbitrary detention, the human rights experts stated that they are deeply distressed by the excessive and unlawful use of force by police and the country's mobile anti-riot squad. The experts have been engaging with authorities and are calling for a thorough and independent investigation. They also urged the authorities to respect the right to peaceful assembly and to ensure that force is used only in compliance with the principles of precaution, necessity, and proportionality. Liz Scafidi, UN News.
This is Deanne Penn with UN News. The outgoing head of the UN team investigating crimes committed by the ISIL terror network in Iraq was in New York this week to give his final report to the Security Council, where he delivered clear evidence of genocide. Karim Khan, special advisor and head of UNITAD, sat down with UN News to take stock of the work his team has done, and he said there was some way to go before justice is done on behalf of the victims of crimes, such as the Yazidis, that rip at the soul of humanity. Matt Wells began by asking him to summarize the report's findings.
There were two findings, in fact, two main findings. The first in relation to the mostly Shia unarmed cadets from Spica to Crete Air Academy, that there was clear and convincing evidence that there are individual members of ISIL that are responsible for direct and public incitement to commit genocide, as well as clear evidence of war crimes. And then in relation to the Yazidis, we announced a finding that compelling evidence that genocide was committed by ISIL, particularly named individuals, named targets that we have for investigation and to put them before courts for genocide against the Yazidi community. And in every way, evidenced by executions, by the policy, by the practice of slavery, sexual slavery, by the practice of deliberately raping women so that they would produce children, knowing that they would no longer be part of the biological group of the Yazidi community. So these are important moments, and we reiterated to the Council that it was imperative to ensure not only that evidence has been collected and that legal findings based upon criminal standard investigations are announced, findings are announced, but also that survivors, victims, and humanity at large have the next piece, which is putting this evidence before courts so that independent and impartial judges can hear what the defense say, analyze our findings, and create a record that should brook no argument, that should stand the test of time, and that should create a record of what ISIL did, the crimes that were committed, because unless we recognize them, we are going to be doomed, and that's what history shows us, it's not hyperbole, we're going to be doomed to see further genocides, further crimes against humanity, further war crimes in other parts of the world, and maybe even in the same part of the world.
And how significant do you hope this report is going to prove to be for Iraq and for the international community overall?
I think it's very important. Government of Iraq is a key partner. I applaud them, both the Kurdish regional government and the Baghdad government, for hosting UNITAD, for supporting the Security Council in its resolution. In fact, the resolution 2379 that is the foundation of our mandate that created UNITAD was only passed because of Iraq's request for support. But we have a distance further to go. The initial findings in relation to two case files is an important moment, but as I said before, we need now to have the fair trials where this evidence can be tested. The other aspect, of course, by December of this year, I have indicated that I think the team will be in a position so that my successor will be able to announce findings in relation to crimes against the Sunni community, crimes against mostly Shia at Badush near Mosul, the crimes against other minorities, and also in relation to the successful manufacturing and deployment of chemical and biological weapons by ISIL. So this is an essential next period, that we build upon the foundations so that we get to the bottom of how ISIL operated, their violent ideology, which is completely contrary to the precepts of humanity, never mind the principles of Islam. And we need to actually have that moment in the court for victims and survivors to realize we don't just give them nice words of support in the council, but there's meaningful accountability because every life matters.
And have you had all the support that you've asked for in recent months? I mean, are there any outstanding areas where you need more assistance, where there have been roadblocks put in your way?
There's always need for continued support. Very often we know, because of the various priorities that are on the desks of decision makers in capitals around the world, their bandwidth sometimes it can be rather challenging. I think there's been fantastic support in the Council for UNITAD. We've had unanimous resolution to pass the resolution. It was unanimously renewed as well. Good support from the government of Iraq. But it's not a wand in which one can simply wave it and say everything's done. We need stamina. We need to be as persistent and as diligent as the survivors in realizing that justice is worth striving for. It requires sometimes toil. It requires that stamina, but unless we show, you know, and go the distance, the consequences, history shows us, can be quite profound. So I think what I would ask for is continued support, and I think from what I've seen from the government of Iraq, from the international community, that I hope and believe and have every expectation that they will continue to support UNITAD, and I think the advocacy of people like Nadia Murad, that will be speaking in a moment at an ARIA formula with myself and the council members, is important. She's the conscience of humanity in many ways in relation to the crimes of Daesh. She puts a mirror up and is a demonstration of how individuals have suffered so much, but also the courage and the demand for justice. We have joint partnerships, not just with states in the council or the government of Iraq, but between UNITAD and religious leaders, UNITAD, the NGO community, UNITAD and human rights advocates like Amal Clooney, who will also speak at the ARIA side event in a moment. And I think the key message is these crimes are of immense consequence. They are ripping at the soul of humanity. We simply cannot continue as business as usual. But in order to do more than provide a fig leaf over cruelty, inhumanity, and failures that have allowed such crimes to befall our fellow brothers and sisters and children around the world, we need to value every human life, and we need to make it clear that this is a common partnership. There's no room for spectators. Every person, every individual, every group has a role to play. We can, all of us, however big the challenge, however high the mountain of accountability may seem, all of us has a part to play.
I mean, how confident are you that Iraq will be able to prosecute ISIL fighters, and what support does the country need, in a sense, beyond the spear, if you like, of the prosecutorial process from here on in?
Well, Iraq is prosecuting ISIL members. They have been before 2379 was passed, but for generic crimes of terrorism. And I think what the Security Council realized, and the government of Iraq, that these are not the types of ad hoc, sporadic terrorism that unfortunately inflict every country throughout the world. There was something unusual. There was a fixed piece of territory that was held by Daesh, and clear evidence to suggest that international crimes, the crime of crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes may have been committed. So what we're looking for, what I'm hoping will be done shortly, is that the legal architecture will be put in place so Iraq can prosecute these crimes not as terrorism, but as genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. There's some reason to hope. Whilst there's been a bill that's had its first reading in Baghdad and it's kind of stuck there for a while, I'm hoping that that will move forward. Last week, the Prime Minister of the KRG, Masroor Barzani, signed a permission that a new bill would be presented in Erbil. And that bill, if all the promises that have been given are kept, and if the revisions that have been suggested by UNITAD are included, will represent a game changer. You know, it is going to be a significant shift, that it would allow the prosecution of Daesh members in accordance with international standards, with guarantees regarding the death penalty that's required by way of the UN policy aspect. So I think that needs to be done, but at the same time, I think there is much to applaud in the government of Iraq already in terms of the interaction between members of UNITAD and the Iraqi judges, and they've been fantastic, quite frankly. The Iraqi judges throughout Iraq, Baghdad, in Mosul, and in the KRG, have really gone out of their way to assist UNITAD. They are increasingly becoming aware and trying, I think, making some genuine efforts in certain quarters to rely less on confessions and more on direct evidence, realizing what we've seen throughout the world. If we don't have evidence, revisionists can later on deny Holocausts. We've seen that. And the best argument against Holocaust denial is the same one that is going to be the argument against a denial of the acts of Daesh were un-Islamic, that they were, you know, to show that they were un-Islamic, to show that they were contrary to the basic precepts of humanity and constitute international crimes, is to preserve the evidence, to present it to courts, to make it available, and then to have an independent set of judges scrutinize it after the defense have had the chance to challenge it. And so a record is created that nobody then can deny. And I think that's really important to cohesion, to stability. And I think that's the lesson of Nuremberg. Nuremberg was important not only because it prevents, you know, Holocaust denial. If anybody now denies the Holocaust, they're viewed as completely racist, anti-Semites, or lunatics, you know, or very dangerous individuals, but they're on that spectrum. There's no really alternative outside those three options. And the other aspect is it managed to separate collective guilt, that the German people as a whole are not the same as the Nazis. And I think that's a very apposite lesson, an important lesson for Iraq, because we have a rich tapestry, a rich mosaic of people, including the Sunni community, and we need to separate the poison of Daesh from the Sunni community. We have many individuals like Nadia Murad whose lives were saved by Sunnis. We have Christians and Shia and Sunnis that joined hands together against a common foe of humanity, which was Daesh. And I think instead of polemics, instead of political statements, the power of the courtroom in an objective way is to present that truth. And individuals then can come together once there is accountability that makes reconciliation a closer prospect than it is at the moment.
Finally, next month you're going to be assuming the position of prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. The ICC charges individuals with the gravest of infractions against the international community, such as the crimes that you've been investigating for these past months in Iraq. Do you think that ISIL leaders and combatants will ultimately appear before the court?
We'll have to wait and see. I mean, the court's jurisdiction is very clear, and there's different gateways for the court to have jurisdiction, and there's gravity thresholds and the rest. One thing is clear. The crimes of Daesh are immense in their magnitude. People have been burnt alive. People have been put in cages and drowned. People have been executed, crucified, thrown off buildings. Children who can hardly speak, that are toddlers, that can barely walk. You have videos of them. It's not hyperbole. You can see it. I mean, Daesh boasted about it, have been given guns to execute people who are unarmed, kneeling in orange suits, almost as if it's something to be proud about. So these crimes need adjudication. We are an investigative team, UNITAD, on the lookout for a courtroom, and I think it is a requirement of all of humanity to ensure there is accountability in fair trials wherever possible, whether that's in domestic courts, in regional courts, in international courts. The obligation on us are not to be passive spectators and to act as if we're looking at a movie or looking at other people's history. This is our collective history. We are part, those of us who breathe at this moment, are part of the march of civilization. And it's incumbent upon all of us to decide, do we march forward or do we go back to the dark age? And I think that needs to be a thought we keep in our minds, because each of us can make a difference. Nadia Murad has, many individuals in Iraq have, many people around the world have, but what we need to have justice is for all of us to join hands in this common partnership based not upon color, creed, religion, but based upon our shared humanity. And if we do that, the prospects are good. If we don't, we're going to see these type of crimes again in other parts of the world, I'm afraid.
Hello, in this week's UN Catch-Up, would you return to your war-shattered country to help rebuild it with your expert knowledge? That's exactly what one Somali doctor did, and she tells us her inspiring story. We'll also hear a news bulletin covering the serious escalation in the Middle East and the Myanmar crisis. It's past the 100-day mark. A call, too, for international criminal court proceedings for genocide against Iraq's Yazidis, and former Liberia President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's appeal for bold World Health Organization reforms to prevent another devastating pandemic from happening again. As ever, comments and poetry from regular guest Solange Behatege-Cortez on the show with me, Daniel Johnson from UN Geneva, and we're recording this at 18:30 hours Central European time on Wednesday the 12th of May. I hope you enjoy the show. First, the news. A World Health Organization, or WHO-appointed panel, has urged bold action to end the COVID-19 crisis, while also calling for the UN agency to be given greater authority to react more quickly to future threats. Our message is simple and clear. The current system failed to protect us from the COVID-19 pandemic, said former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, co-chair of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response. She added that if we do not act to change it now, it will not protect us from the next pandemic threat, which could happen at any time. The panel insisted that many more countries could have done more to contain the spread of the coronavirus once the WHO declared a public health emergency of international concern on the 30th of January last year, after the initial outbreak in Wuhan, China. A top UN envoy has added his voice to calls for calm in the occupied Palestinian territory, warning that the situation is escalating towards a full-scale war amid continuing airstrikes and rocket attacks. In a tweet ahead of a closed-door meeting with the UN Security Council on Wednesday, Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Tor Wensland, appealed to the Palestinian authorities and Israelis for an immediate end to hostilities before a devastating conflict breaks out. The appeal echoes a plea for maximum restraint and calm to Israel and Palestinians from the UN Secretary-General and several UN agencies and organizations. The development comes after weeks of clashes between Palestinian demonstrators and Israeli police in Jerusalem's Old City, fueled by the potential eviction of Palestinian families from the neighborhoods of Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. Late on Tuesday, the UN reported that 10 children were among 28 killed in Gaza by Israeli airstrikes and that two women had been killed in Israel after rockets were fired from Gaza. The killing of thousands of Yazidi people in Iraq by ISIL extremists was genocide, the Security Council has heard. Delivering its findings to the 15-member body, the UN team investigating the atrocities said that it had established clear and convincing evidence of the crime against the religious minority in 2014. At that time, the terror group attacked, enslaved, and killed members of the Yazidi community in Sinjar, northern Iraq, forcibly displacing around 500,000 of them. One of the survivors, Nobel Peace Prize laureate Nadia Murad, urged the Security Council to refer the matter to the International Criminal Court to address the universal magnitude of the group's crimes against humanity.
Evidence has been found, but we are still searching for the political will to prosecute. It is time for the international community to do more than listen. It is time to act. If world leaders have the political will to act on this evidence, then justice is surely within reach. ISIS's genocide will not come to an end until all Yazidis can live a life of dignity in their homeland.
Finally, just over 100 days since the Myanmar military seized power, the repression of protesters has continued despite all international efforts to end the violence, the UN Rights Office has said. Credible reports indicate that more than 780 people have been killed after security forces used unnecessary, disproportionate and lethal force since the 1st of February, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, or OHCHR, said on Tuesday. Spokesperson Rupert Colville urged greater international involvement to prevent the human rights situation there from deteriorating further. Mr. Colville also warned about the disturbing and illegal detention tactics now being used to capture opponents of the coup.
We've certainly noticed what appears to be an intensifying trend of the military authorities taking relatives, family members of people they want, opposition, civil society, journalists and so on, taking them into custody in what appears to be a pretty blatant effort to force the people they want to get hold of to turn themselves in. And clearly that's a human rights violation.
The news there, and this is UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. Now to this week's interview. A happy story for a change. It comes from Somali paediatrician Dr. Abba Farah, who decided to return to Mogadishu after leaving the country during civil war in the 1990s. She's been helped by IOM, which is the UN Migration Agency, and its Migration for Development in Africa project, as we'll find out. But first, let's hear from Dr. Abba herself, talking about why she left Italy for the Banadir Hospital in the Somali capital, where she's saving lives every day.
I decided to be back to Somalia because there's a massive need of my specialization and my qualification as a doctor. It was a long dream since I was a child. As you know, I'm born and raised in Mogadishu. Unfortunately, civil war happened in the 90s here in Somalia. I fled and went to Italy. And I always dreamt to be back to Mogadishu, to give back what I had. I'm more fortunate than most of Somalis like me who didn't have the opportunity to have a highly qualified studies and environment.
I've seen you say before that every minute counts when a baby is born, and that just wasn't happening in Mogadishu where you were. There really wasn't that level of specialist care.
Absolutely. There's no my specialization and my care. As you see, the first minute is so need for the newborns. I introduce it.
So can you describe a typical day for me in the Banadir Hospital in Mogadishu where you're working?
Banadir Hospital is a referral and regional hospital in Mogadishu. My daily, it consists that I arrive 8 in the morning. We have a morning meeting that we hand over what happened the night and we will start the job. We have 20 incubators that are all patients in need, prematures and babies with severe illness like sepsis, meningitis and tetanus. And I have to handle all of it.
And you decided to come back to Mogadishu because you had to leave in the first place following the government collapse in 1991, civil war. There's ongoing violence. It must nonetheless have been a very difficult decision to come back, wasn't it?
Yes, after 30 years abroad, I decided, because I belong to this place, I belong to these people, and I owe them, I have to give back. I don't know, it's something that I feel inside.
And one of the reasons, we should say, that you went back to Mogadishu is because your father is quite elderly now and you wanted to get back, but to get to him, you had to leave behind your two boys back in Rome. So what do they think about your departure to Mogadishu?
My my son and daughters are really not so happy that I left them in Rome, but sometimes remind me what I did when I was at their age. The same thing, I was alone in Rome. Here in Mogadishu, I have, yes, my father, 83 years old, and I didn't have much time to spend with him.
Well, I'm very glad you have got to see him and you're playing catch-up. Are there many more people in the Somali diaspora like you who are keen to come back to the country to share their knowledge?
Yeah, there's a lot of worldwide specialist doctors from the diaspora who are willing to come back, but they are still afraid about the situation, the security in Mogadishu.
And I should say that this interview we tried to do at the end of April, but there was the election violence and you were caught up in it, and in fact some concern about how you were doing. So I'm sure you weren't naive about coming back to Somalia, but were you expecting to be that close to the front line, so to speak?
Yes, I had 3 days, terrible, because I was in the middle of the war. It took me back to 90s, but different to the 90s, I was adolescent. I hadn't the responsibility that I had now. It was really terrible, terrible. I can't explain it with words. But after the peace declaration of the Prime Minister, it gives me another hope to stay and continue my work in Mogadishu.
So really, that's my question. You don't have any regrets about coming back to Somalia?
Absolutely, I have nothing to regret it, nothing. My hope to remain here and my desire is still there. I think I can change better the life and the health system of Somalia, and especially Mogadishu.
Well, I wish you all the very best for that. And if you could stay with us, I'd just like to turn quickly to Sikulile Dlamini from the International Organization for Migration. And you're really involved in this program, this Migration for Development in Africa, or MIDA program. So maybe you could give me an update, because it started back in 2008, but we're really seeing the benefits and the fruits of all the agency's hard work now, aren't we?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to your listeners about the program that IOM implements in Somalia, the Migration for Development in Africa program, to strengthen the institutions and government institutions in Somalia to ultimately contribute to national development agenda.
We can see that there's huge needs. So where do you start?
Certainly the needs are very many, but through the program, we have managed to bring a lot of Somali professionals back into the country. And the good thing about Somalis is that they remain connected to their home country. So over the years, we've assigned more than 500 people to different government institutions in the country. The key sectors that we have supported and continue to support is health. Health for all is extremely important. Health contributes to overall national development. And we're also currently supporting the education sector and various other government institutions. So our contribution has really resulted into tangible outcomes. You know, in hospitals where Dr. Uba works, the staff in the hospitals have been trained by the diaspora experts. So the program facilitates the transfer of knowledge and skills to the local professionals so that when the diaspora experts leave the program, at least we would have contributed in a sustainable manner the transfer of the knowledge that they have acquired abroad.
Thanks to Dr. Uba Farah there from Mogadishu in Somalia for explaining her decision to head back to the country after fleeing civil war there in the 90s. No regrets, despite the dangers which sounded terrifying and very, very close to her. She is an amazing woman. Thanks also to Sikulili Dlamini from the UN Migration Agency, IOM, for putting the Migration for Development in Africa program into context. Right, to wrap up the show, it's my pleasure to welcome back Solange Berhotege-Cortez from the Information Service at UN Geneva. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel.
Wasn't that an uplifting story of love and solidarity, Solange?
Definitely. And love can be a political concept, a motor for change. That was really a powerful story. When Uba Farah was a child, let's say that a strong wind hit her. She was forced to leave Somalia to seek shelter in Italy with the outbreak of civil war in 1991. Dr. Uba is a brave woman. Leaving Italy after 30 years, you need to be brave to let yourself be carried away again by the wind, to leave your country for a second time. If the wind carried dreams, then we could say that it made her return to her homeland. But where is home? And the one who returns, are they still the same? The war drove Dr. Uba away from Somalia, and another kind of war brought her back, the war against neonatal deaths. She knows the reality and the culture of her country, which make it easier the relationship she has with new mothers in the hospital. Today, thanks to the Migration for Development in Africa program, almost 500 members of the diaspora have returned to Somalia and now provide support in a wide range of areas. It is a great initiative because it gives meaning to the journey of many immigrants. It makes sense, social sense.
It does make total sense, and it wouldn't be the podcast wrap, Solange, without a poetic reference. Please, tell me, who have you got for us this week?
There is a Somali poet, Maxamed Ibrahim Warsame, popularly known as Hadrawi, and even the Somali Shakespeare. Hadrawi heals Somalia's wounds through words. Others' poems are driven by the wind, like a tornado. They turn wherever and in whatever direction. And you know, Daniel, with words you can change the direction of the wind. Let's follow a healing wind, and perhaps we will be able to soothe the wounds of thousands of immigrants around the world.
Thank you, Solange, for that poetic end to the show as ever. Words are powerful. We hope we're communicating a positive message. I will be keeping an eye out for Maxamed Ibrahim Warsame Hadrawi's work. Although I have to say, Solange, it's impossible to find, even online. My thanks also to Justine Bryce for putting the podcast online shortly and for all the unsung promotional work that she does for us on social media, which you can follow at UN Geneva. Please, we'd be happy to hear from you. Listeners, of course, as I was saying, we'd be nothing without you, so thanks for being with us for this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva. Don't forget there's a daily news bulletin from UN News Online and a stack of stories on the UN News website if you want more from the United Nations. That's it from me. Bye-bye for now.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The top UN humanitarian official in South Sudan has called for law enforcement along roads following the killing of an aid worker in an ambush in eastern Equatoria on Wednesday. The aid worker was killed when assailants fired at a clearly marked humanitarian vehicle that was part of a team of international non-governmental organizations and South Sudanese health workers traveling to a health facility. The team was driving in an area that has seen several roadside ambushes this year. In a statement on Thursday, UN Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan, Alain Nodahu, condemned the killing and urged the government to strengthen law enforcement on roads, which he called a vital connection between aid organizations and the communities they serve. The incident marked the first killing of an aid worker in South Sudan this year. 9 aid workers were killed in 2020. Moving to Iraq, where the International Labour Organization, the ILO, and partners this week launched a nationwide campaign to combat the worst forms of child labour in the country. The campaign will target 10,000 children, their families and guardians, teachers, employers, and the media through a series of activities that aim to raise awareness on the increasing dangers of the issue. ILO reports child labour has been on the rise in Iraq in recent years. A growing number of children has been forced to work due to a combination of factors that include armed conflict, displacement, and economic challenges, which have been further compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic. The campaign aims to inform communities about the negative consequences of child labour and ultimately change behaviour by making the practice unacceptable and an urgent priority for action by the authorities and businesses. And finally, looking to next week when UN Trade and Development Body UNCTAD will bring together experts to explore how science, technology and innovation, or STI, can contribute to achieving sustainable and resilient recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. The meeting of the UN Commission on Science and Technology for Development, which begins on Monday, will examine how STI can help rebuild healthcare systems and socioeconomic structures while reducing inequalities which the pandemic has exposed. Experts will also look at opportunities offered by so-called frontier technologies, some of which are being used in pandemic response, such as artificial intelligence, big data, and robotics. Diane Penn, UN News.
Control, eradication, control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
That's the British actor Michael Redgrave at the microphone in 1958, highlighting the core philosophy on which the World Health Organization, WHO, was founded and to which it still aspires today. I'm Omar Musni, and welcome to another classic podcast from the vaults of our unique audiovisual archive here at UN headquarters in New York. Everyone everywhere has a right to benefit from health services they need without sacrificing other life necessities, and everyone can play a part on the path to universal health care. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus addressed the issue immediately upon his election as WHO Director General.
At present, only about half of the world's people have access to health care without impoverishment. This needs to improve dramatically.
Indeed, on the occasion of World Health Day, the WHO data make it clear billions around the world are still missing out on basic services, while 100 million are being pushed into extreme poverty due to crippling healthcare costs. But as we're about to hear in this UN Radio, WHO, and BBC collaboration, enormous progress had already been made in the Health Watchdog's first 10 years and continue 60 years later. Listen now as 10 Steps Forward takes us backwards in time to when disease ran rampant in the streets of even the most advanced societies on Earth.
Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead.
Death carts in the streets, red crosses of warning on the doors, corpses tumbled naked into the plague pits. That was London in 1665.
Bring out your dead! Bring out your dead!
Epidemiological bulletin of the World Health Organization's top. Section 1, this is today. On the World Health Organization, created just 10 years ago to keep watch on the health of the world, and to deal, among many other things, with such epidemics as that in 1947. Send off the following telegram to the Pasteur Institute in Paris, the Lister Institute in London, the Hafkeen Institute in Bombay,
Seen this cable about cholera vaccine? Well, we've just three questions to answer. How much vaccine have we in hand? And how much more can we produce in a week? How soon can we get it to Cairo? It's quite an order.
Motorcycle escorts to LaGuardia Airport, New York. But not this time escorting a very important person, just a very important vaccine. For that was October 1947, and in Egypt, there were 33,000 cases of cholera. But in a few months...
Geneva, February 18th, 1948. Egypt now declares whole country free from cholera.
A victory for the International Guardians of Health. WHO did not yet officially exist, but it was already functioning. And 2 months later, on the 7th of April, 1948, its constitution came into force. At a time when, in the words of its first Director General, Dr. Brock Chisholm,
"We had just come out of a catastrophic world war, which had reminded people that ours was a small planet. Until quite recently, man's environment had been his locality only, his village or town, or at the most his own country. He had learned to live more or less at peace with his own emotions and had contrived to get along with his immediate neighbors. Now that situation had changed entirely. The environment of every person was the whole world, and it was essential to the health of every individual that he develop beyond the capacity to live with his own kind of people only and be able to live with all the kinds of people all over the world. This, and the concept of health, was not just the absence of sickness or of infirmity, but a positive aim was a new sort of idea. That was why we chose the name World Health Organization."
A new sort of idea on a small planet. A planet which is still divided by frontiers, but those frontiers, as ever, can be crossed by the carriers of disease, by rat and bat, by insect and virus. They can also be crossed by an idea, especially by this new sort of idea. In your different countries, you have different problems.
We have roughly 1,500 patients, and we are terribly understaffed. Roughly 8 to 10 male nurses and about 10 or 12 female nurses. Most of the work is done by untrained staff who attend to the general needs of the patient.
That is a mental hospital in Singapore.
The local society for the welfare of crippled children in Lebanon was formed chiefly through the good offices of a Dr. Harfouche. She was rather appalled by the large number of undernourished and crippled children in Lebanon and indeed throughout the whole of the Middle East.
While further east still, in the Punjab in India.
It was a little difficult. At first we had to get cooperation of the village dai or local midwife, and we tried to get her to realize that she needed a certain amount of training.
Training is nearly everywhere a problem. Training of midwives, training of nurses.
It's very difficult to get suitable girls of a good standard of education to be nurses.
So says one of the few women doctors in Iraq.
There's a constant argument that goes on as to what kind of food a child ought to be given at any stage. Also, there's a constant difference of opinion as to the proper kinds of food for mothers after they've been delivered.
That is in Formosa, an island where, in fact...
In fact, in some areas there were no roads at all, and the midwife had to rush along on a bicycle between the rice paddies either side along a path that was scarcely 18 inches wide, and she wobbled along here until she reached a river, and when she reached the river, off she had to come off her bicycle, fling the bicycle over her shoulder, and go across the river as best she could.
Yes, different problems in different countries. But the end is everywhere the same. Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So runs the first clause in our Constitution. And every year, at the World Health Assembly, East meets West to discuss that aim. We talk of privileged countries and underdeveloped countries, But in health, there's no one-way traffic. A two-way, a many-way traffic. And we're now controlling it better, with signposts and lights and rules of the road. WHO holds a watching brief, watching and checking and double-checking and warning.
Section 1, week ended 20th July, cholera, Pakistan, Chittagong 1, India, Calcutta 36, stop, smallpox, Sierra Leone, Freetown 5, Sudan, Port Sudan 2, Pakistan, Karachi 2, Lahore 3.
A constant eye for infectious diseases. In these last 10 years, such diseases have rapidly decreased. Look at the historic scourges like cholera, typhus, smallpox, plague, relapsing fever, yellow fever. But WHO is not only concerned with epidemics, it's concerned with your whole life, from the cradle and indeed from before it.
Schlafe, mein Prinzchen, schlaf ein, es ruhen nun Schäfchen und Vögelein.
This cradle song used to be attributed to Mozart. We now know that it was composed by an amateur musician, a doctor of medicine, in Berlin towards the end of the 18th century, when conditions in Berlin and all through Europe were as bad as they are now in the underdeveloped countries. Mothers continually dying in childbirth, children dying at birth or in infancy. Dr. Bernhard Fleiss's lullaby is still sung. Sleep, my little prince, go to sleep. But now, he's more likely to sleep sound. Sleep, come to the eyes of my child. Your uncle, the moon, will enrich your dreams. So Indian mothers sing in Hindi. But they and their children are still surrounded by perils. It is those perils that WHO is combating. The welfare of mother and child is one of its chief concerns. And already in many countries this work is bearing fruit. The child is more likely to sleep sound, the music less likely to break off. After the danger of birth comes the danger of weaning. There is a disease of small children which often leads to death before the child's third birthday. It is well known to Dr. Omondi, one of the few African doctors in Kenya.
In Kenya, there's a great deal of malnutrition, particularly of children who have previously been weaned and have been put to a diet which is deficient in proteins. And since they cannot get that protein, their growth is deficient, and these children are liable to a lot of infections such as bronchopneumonia and chronic malaria and worms. So malnutrition is a real problem in Kenya, which is being faced and which I hope will be under control in some time to come.
Undernourished children and crippled children. There are many of the latter in the Lebanon. Dr. Kraft went out there from Britain a few years ago to start up the first Lebanese center for crippled children.
A number of the children were not only located around Beirut, but at distances from the city. Now, Lebanon, as anybody will know, is a country rather more mountainous than Switzerland. Travelling is extremely difficult. Distances, not so much, but it's the travelling. To get anybody to the centre at 6 o'clock in the morning meant leaving at midnight the night before. So we had to make a very large dormitory. This proved wonderfully successful.
So it goes on, watching the mother before and during and after the birth of her child, and watching that child in turn through the years of its growing up. And as it grows up, some menaces fall away, but new ones will take their place. It's the same with countries. As a country becomes more developed, certain diseases decrease, but others acquire a new prominence. For instance, poliomyelitis, that disease which can cripple you for life. Dr. A.M. Payne from Geneva has followed and taken part in the campaign against polio since the Second World War.
During and after the last World War, there had been an alarming increase in poliomyelitis in some countries. And this was very disturbing because at that time there was no prospect of being able to do anything about it. But the real breakthrough came in 1949 when Enders and his colleagues discovered that the virus could be grown in tissue culture. This completely altered the prospects of controlling the disease because it opened the possibility of being able to manufacture a vaccine against the disease.
Such a vaccine was manufactured, what is known as an inactivated vaccine. But hopes are now being placed on something more active, more sweeping, a live virus vaccine which will strike at the roots of this disease.
Trials of the live virus vaccine are now going on in the United States, the USSR, the Netherlands, Mexico, South Africa, and they're also being planned in a number of other countries. But meanwhile, of course, considerable success has been recorded in the United States in recent years in reducing the incidence of polio through the use of the Salk vaccine.
But there are other diseases. The malaria, the disease which may have killed Alexander the Great and later destroyed the Roman Empire. A disease which is carried by mosquitoes and can spread like wildfire. In the words of Dr. P.F. Russell, a WHO consultant.
So it goes on and on, mosquito to man to mosquito to man, until almost everyone in a community has the disease. Probably 200 million persons were infected with malaria in this way in 1955. Those who have malaria naturally become anemic. They lack vitality and ambition, can't farm or work properly, can't provide for their families, get into debt, or maybe die prematurely. Without doubt, malaria is bad for an individual, bad for a community, and bad for a nation.
In the middle 1930s in Ceylon, the malaria death roll was enormous. 10 years later, they took to DDT, and within 3 years, the death rate was down by 82.5%. Ceylon was rightly proud of this achievement. The mosquitoes, it was thought, were defeated. But in regard to malaria, the word control is already out of date. On October the 7th, 1954, a report was received at WHO headquarters. It came from a Greek doctor, Peter Issaris, leader of the malaria team in Indonesia. On the north coast of Java, DDT resistance has appeared in Anopheles sundaicus, which meant that everyone had to think again. Anopheles sundaicus is a malarial mosquito, and according to this report, to this bombshell, it was breeding itself immune to insecticides. This meant that within a few years, this new breed of resistant mosquitoes would have multiplied to the point where it would menace mankind. So the World Health Assembly of 1955 made a very bold resolution. They resolved to eradicate malaria. And WHO now has a division of malaria eradication. Its director is Dr. Pampana of Italy.
Well, I think that now you can say that the present policy of WHO is no longer control, but eradication. And as Siakot Mudaliar said in 1957 at the World Health Assembly,
we in India are particularly interested in this program because for many years we have been fighting this scourge of malaria. And I am glad to note from the Director General's report that more and more countries are now coming to believe that the proper way of controlling malaria is not by control but by eradication.
Control, eradication, control, eradication. The experts repeat themselves, but they have to repeat themselves, for this is a fight against time. And there are other things, too, in this strange new world of ours, which involve a fight against time. Did you expect a clock? No. Those are Geiger counters, which represent a new kind of energy and involve a new attitude to time. This, people say, this is the atomic age. And for better or worse, they are right. And WHO, on behalf of one and all of you, is trying to bring this all-important question into the sphere of the knowable and controllable. Dr. I.S. Eve, who is now in the Director General's office of WHO at Geneva, was previously medical officer at Windscale. It was a logical transfer. His subject is radiation protection.
One of the most important things we think we can do in this subject of protection is training. We are anxious that knowledge of protection measures shall spread across the earth as rapidly as the spread of atomic energy itself. Sir Henry Cowan, Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Health for Scotland, has made a very interesting statement at the last World Health Assembly.
The future of the population of the world
is indissolubly linked with the development of sources of nuclear energy. Exploitation of new sources of energy, which will flow and develop from the first halting steps in the use of fission processes, can bestow ineffable benefits on mankind. The evolution of these processes can be left to the nuclear physicist, but the hazards are the concern of the biophysicist and the health worker.
The hazards are the concern of all of us. There they go again, the clock of the atomic age, the life pulse of one and all of you. And to some of you, this pulse seems feverish. The thought of it adds to your nervous strain. But your nervous strain, your mental health, is also the concern of WHO. You remember that first clause, first challenge, first statement of faith? Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. No, not merely the absence. Here, as elsewhere, we cannot afford to be negative. We cannot go back to the old days.
Bring out your dead!
No, you're living. Take off that tolling bell. We must bring out our living. Living in every sense, physically, mentally, socially. This small planet is big with the future. And that future will live in our children, and that future itself is like a child, and it has many possibilities. Some of them we have mentioned today, but there are many others which are on the agenda. The agenda of World Health Organization.
That was an edited version of 10 Steps Forward, narrated by British stage and screen actor Michael Redgrave to mark the 10th anniversary of WHO in 1958. As he said, the WHO agenda includes many topics and has since expanded to address such issues as substance abuse, road safety, and clean energy, among others. That's it for this edition of our podcast classics series. You can find a wealth of other audio, film, and video by going to www.unmultimedia.org/AVLibrary. This unique collection of material goes back to the 1940s and the founding of the United Nations. I'm Omar Musni, and thanks for listening.